Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. And of course, thanks to Daniel Baker for the last hour. And now we have for you an hour of food and drink with Alan Alder, Dr. Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman.
And today we have Sarah Lavelle talking about five new cookbooks from Quadril.
Steve Hovington from Cambridge Wine Academy talking about the Chardonnay grape. We speak with Hans Schweitzer of Cotto about his extraordinary career.
And as we have as our featured food, elderberries, very seasonal, and top Cambridge chef Alex Rushmer has some ideas for using them. We also have our usual features, the food and drink news for Cambridge, and we'll be keeping our eyes on what's going on Twitter too.
Earlier in the week, Sarah Lavelle, publishing director at Quadril, came into the studio to talk about five new books. The first is Big Salad by Kat Mead, which, as Sarah says, had an unusual inspiration.
The funny thing about Big Salads is that the origin of it is a Seinfeld episode called The Big Salad. And in it, Elaine wants this particular salad and has to specify to George Costanza that it's the big salad, and it causes all sorts of problems. So I had in my head from first seeing this episode of Seinfeld, probably about 20 years ago, that I wanted to do a book called Big Salads. And Kat Mead is this fabulous, fabulous chef and food stylist, and she just got it instantly. When we talked about it, we talked a lot about the influence of the US West Coast, that kind of Californian vibe, but also that sort of Sydney food, kind of cafe-ish, but amazing sort of heaving plates of gorgeous fresh ingredients. And Kat just got this instantly and went off and wrote these absolutely wonderful recipes that have ended up in Big Salads.
Yeah, I must say I like the idea behind it, and I like actually what it isn't. I think she says somewhere that the salad doesn't have to be limp lettuce, an average vinaigrette, something served cold, something you feel you should eat rather than want to, something drab, and also that it's a meal in itself. She says it's not a flotilla of small plates. So she does seem to have a very strong, you know, concept of what a salad can be.
That's right. We loved the idea of a contemporary dinner party, if you like, being about a table with platters full of salad rather than all these tiny little tapas-style plates. And then when you're preparing your food, all you have to do is make sort of three salads, big salads, and it would feed about eight people. And it's just the way that a lot of people like to eat now and to entertain.
And it's done by season as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The ingredients are all seasonal, and actually they're, although they're not all vegetarian or vegan, overall they do minimise the meat element and they make the most of fresh veg and fruit. So really the protein content in most of the salads, I would say, comes from non-meat or fish sources, and there are lots of pulses, grains, and seeds as well. So you can always, I guess if you were vegetarian, you could always just leave out that very small sort of meat or fish element. And they're pretty much, most of them can be converted into a veggie dish.
Yeah. And some fantastically colourful. There's an autumn one, which I picked out since we're sort of heading that way. Beetroot and blackberry salad with walnut oil. That does sound pretty marvellous.
That's a beautiful one. Yeah, you're right. Visually, it's absolutely gorgeous. Those rich, you know, reds and earthy colours. Yeah, gorgeous. And the summer ones are really, really sunny looking, and she uses pineapple and gorgeous veg.
And things like griddled peaches with watercress and ricotta salad.
Just, that's amazing. Yeah, fruit's really great to use in salads, actually. A bit of charring, and it can just totally lift a salad. So, yeah, I would love to think that people would cook from it and eat it all year round. Salad is not just for summer.
And I noticed in the acknowledgements she thanked the mighty Sarah Lavelle.
Well, what can I say?
Right, let's move on to Copenhagen food.
Yes, Copenhagen Foods by Trine Hanneman, who is an absolutely wonderful Danish writer. She's lived in Copenhagen for, I think, over 40 years. And she's just this year opened her own cafe and bakery in the city. But she's got a wealth of knowledge about where to eat, where to visit in Copenhagen, so it made sense. I think it was the book that Trina's really wanted to write for a very long time.
Well, I noticed that it was her seventh book in English. Mm. She has some that I think which probably haven't been translated. And it did strike me as being a book that was, you know, obviously very much of her. So I suppose it is surprising it didn't come earlier, really.
Yes, it's her personal guide to a city that probably more and more of us have visited now. And, you know, it is so interesting to see how what an influence Copenhagen's had on the way we eat, the way we cook, certainly on high-end chefs, if you think about Noma being, you know, probably the world's most well-known destination restaurant. Copenhagen has become a food destination in itself, probably in the past 10 years. And also we have so much going on in the UK in terms of Scandinavian trends. You know, obviously furniture would be one, but also fashion, increasingly fashion, I think. And we went through the whole hygge trend. But that sort of Scandi aesthetic is absolutely everywhere. And I think it's something that feels very familiar to people in the UK. And then if you look at food, things like fermentation is what everyone's talking about.
But although you mentioned Noma, the recipes in this book are far more accessible than the...
Trina's cooking is really, really accessible. Although she's a great writer, she's firmly a sort of home cook. And the two previous ones that we did was Scandinavian baking. She has some amazing, amazing recipes for breads and cakes. It's just lovely, down-to-earth food.
Well, things like, let's see, there was rhubarb tartlets. Mm. Actually, they're quite big on rhubarb in Scandinavia, aren't they? Which endears them to me.
Always pickling it as well.
And there was chicken in horseradish and fennel sauce, which sounded rather splendid. And tartlets with mushrooms and cream, choux pastry buns. Yeah, there's a lot in there that I want to eat. And yes, you talked about baking. There's cinnamon crinsel, a soft, sweet bread. So, and also a beetroot and celeriac cakes with potato wedges, which sounded rather... Because you look at celeriac and wonder what to do with it. So.
Yes.
Now we know.
But she has a great relationship with her photographer, Columbus Leth. They spent the best part of a year doing the photography for the book and just going around the city. And I think it looks absolutely stunning.
Well, that makes me wonder how much work goes into a book like this. How many hours' work must go into them?
I don't know how many hours it is, but it's when there's a travel element, it really is months and months and months, because there's also then a seasonal element, because you want to reflect the entire year. So there's so much planning, and there's such a, for, you know, for a book where there's travel involved, you've really got to know what you're doing 18 months in advance and have it all planned out. And, you know, the authors work in different ways with photographers. I've got New Gilmela book, Time, which is a follow-up to Gather, and he works very closely with his photographer, Andrew Montgomery. And the way they do it is Andrew just, he basically goes and visits Gil for a couple of days a week over the course of pretty much a year, and they assemble this whole portfolio of images so that by the end of it, you've got thousands to choose from. Then you've got that editing down process. And again, with Trina, Columbus is, you know, there in Copenhagen, and I think they meet up occasionally. So it can be done quite informally.
So there's a lot of cost involved in producing a cookbook, then.
Yeah, these big illustrated cookbooks, they're really, really expensive to do. The origination costs on them are huge, and then factor into that the printing as well, and all these beautiful finishes like foil and sprayed edges and ribbons. Yes. So yeah, they are labours of love.
Yes. So you've got to be pretty convinced that a book's going to sell.
Well, sometimes we do it for the love of it, but yes, it would be nice if we did sell a few copies along the way.
Yeah. Right, Vegan Christmas by Gaz Oakley, which is a pretty extraordinary book, I think. And that's full of, obviously, pictures, seasonal pictures, but I guess they weren't taken last Christmas. They were probably taken in the heat of summer or something.
Yeah, I
like
think
that.
They were. I think it was July, so I felt a bit sorry for Gaz having to wear his jumper on the front of it. But it's, you go through, not just with books, but I think with the food magazines as well, you go through quite a funny period in sort of June, July, whereby all the food stylists are having to do Christmas shoots in absolutely sweltering temperatures and running around trying to get hold of Christmas trees. And
oh, right, but this book, Vegan Christmas, is recreating a Christmas meal or Christmas meals without meat. When I say recreating, the turkey is recreated, but it's not
turkey. But it's not turkey.
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing. I think more and more people are finding that at Christmas dinner, there's going to be somebody at the table who's vegetarian or increasingly vegan. I mean, 2018 has been the biggest year I can think of in terms of veganism, popularity of the books, but also more and more people saying that they are, you know, trying out veganism. So the idea behind the Christmas book, and it was Gaz's idea because he hadn't seen any other publishing for Christmas cooking for vegans. And it's that you've always got an option. You don't have to be vegan to buy the book, but if you're cooking the whole huge family meal or for friends, you've got loads of options in there. And people miss, you know, they want, if they've given up animal products, they do want something at Christmas that they sort of feel used to. So his idea was to try and recreate some of those favourite things, like the one that I always smile at is the no pigs in blankets, or a thing like a Wellington, just so that, you know, it does feel suitably celebratory at the Christmas lunch.
Yes, well, yes, the turkey. The main ingredients, other than sort of flavourings and spicings and so on, of the turkey seems to be oat or soy milk, mushrooms, chickpeas and miso paste. And I think to create a turkey out of that is... Because it's not just cooking the food, is it? It's making it like making the streaky bacon.
Yes, out of coconut chips. Yeah. It's really, really clever. He spent so long developing these recipes, and he's got a phenomenal following on YouTube. He's certainly around kind of 400,000 followers on YouTube, I think, if not more now. Every time I check, it's more and more, and over 200,000 on Instagram. And he gets huge number of views for his videos that he posts. He did one which was on high protein vegan meal, and I think he's got close to 2 million views. It's sort of extraordinary. And he's speaking not only to people in the UK, you know, he's got a huge following in the US. So he's going over for a US tour around the Christmas book, and he's, you know, his events at bookshop signings are sort of sold out.
Gosh.
Purely through YouTube. It's changed the way that we can sell books or get books out there or build new chefs. He was a chef, and you know, he just got on there, did his own videos, and developed this following. It's amazing,
astonishing. Right. And is this book available now?
It is. Yes, it came out beginning of September.
Right. Okay. Because I think you need quite a lot of time to practice, which is why I was wondering. Right. Finally, Susanna Forbes, The Cider Insider, which is a sort of an extraordinary guide to the world's cider, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I like cider quite a lot, and there's been a huge amount of publishing around craft beer, and I just kept seeing, I mean, as I say, I like cider, so I'm aware of new brands or types that have been exploding in popularity in the last few years. I couldn't see a book on the subject or that was a guide to types of cider as well as the brands. So I met up with Susanna, who is a beer and cider writer for Imbibe magazine, but she also runs a cidery called Little Pomona out in Herefordshire. And she just loved the idea and said, yeah, absolutely, this is what is needed. And she travelled, she met cider makers from all over the world. And indeed, when I first talked to her about this, I had absolutely no idea how popular cider was all over the world. I mean, the UK is definitely the heart of it, but Spain, they absolutely love cider in Spain. And in the US, notably, there's some amazing cider makers coming through. So yeah, it sort of started quite small. We thought, well, maybe it would be a guide to the kind of the West Country, and then it's just, I think she almost didn't have room because we ended up with about 100 from all over the world.
Are these ciders from all over the world purchasable?
Yes, they are. I went into Bacchanalia and found at least three of the ciders that Susanna had recommended in the book. So, yeah, they're right here on our doorsteps. Yeah, I think the supermarkets have quite a few of them as well. Once you start looking, you can find them. I think we need a dedicated cider shop in Cambridge, actually. There's one in Bristol and it's absolutely amazing. It has all of these. But I'm also lucky in that around the corner from my office in Borough Market, there is a cider shop. So they have quite a few of them.
And on a previous visit, Sarah, we talked about a home brewing book by James Morton I think a bread book by James Morton. And now James and Tom Morton have a book about Shetland.
They do. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I just sit down and read it because it's just the most wonderful, evocative, funny love letter to Shetland. James grew up there and, you know, he had sort of 20 years of being in Shetland, cooking with his gran, which is what inspired him to then go on to Bake Off. And he was a finalist on, I think it was the third series of Bake Off. So he's since done books on bread and baking and beer. But we were talking about the next book and, you know, it's so important. Shetland is such a huge part of his cooking and who he is that we said, well, let's just do a book about Shetland. And then when you decide that, you then start seeing Shetland everywhere. That the BBC series was hugely popular. James's father, Tom, is a radio presenter and he's got wonderful stories about Shetland, having lived there, you know, for many, many years. So he ended up co-writing the book with James because we just thought, well, to get, you know, all that nostalgia and tales in, it'd be great if Tom were involved. And he's a very experienced author. And we sent Andy Sewell, who's a photographer, up to Shetland a couple of times. And they had an extraordinary amount of fun. They did a huge fire pit feast on the beach. They went to the Viking festival, the Uphelia, the annual Viking festival. So we've got beautiful, beautiful pictures in there. But really, it's just about, it's about family and it's about community. And it's about this absolutely stunning place. And there are recipes in there too. So it's not your average cookbook.
Yeah, I agreed. And actually in there, right at the beginning of the book, he says, it's Shetland, it's not the Shetland Islands.
It's Shetland,
yes. It's Shetland, which I don't think I realised, but I certainly do now. But yes, I agree with you. The photographs are just fantastic. Some lovely misty sea
yes,
shots and things like that. Yeah, and some great recipes as well.
Yes, yeah.
And that book is out now, I know, because I've seen it.
That book is out now, yes. It was available from the beginning of September. Yeah, there's a great shortbread recipe in there. Should try.
Oh, right. Right. Well, thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, many thanks to Sarah Lavelle for talking about those new books. And they were Big Salad by Kat Mead, Copenhagen Food by Trina Hahnemann, Vegan Christmas by Gaz Oakley, The Cider Insider by Susanna Forbes, and Shetland by James and Tom Morton.
Very interesting.
Mm. Yeah, they are. I mean, they're all really interesting. And there was another one Sarah talked about called Black Sea, an astonishing book. The food of the area of the countries around the Black Sea, so places like Romania, Ukraine, Turkey, and so on. And that book is due out in November, so we'll save that interview.
Sounds great.
Sometime in October.
Oh, dear. You're filling my addiction to cookery books.
Well, I wondered if you...
Oh, yes.
Good for you.
I have too many bookshelves of too many cookery books.
Any idea how many you've got?
I wouldn't like to say. They span from the sort of whole range of 20th century cookery books and all the sort of fascinating ones that people have forgotten about, and the fact that, you know, book illustration, there were so many cookery books where you had to in one sense inspire by the ideas but then also make do with simple ingredients but then give a bit of inspiration. I mean, I've got Ambrose Heath and all sorts of intriguing ones.
Right, well, maybe you should do a little feature for us about
it. I would love to.
Okay.
So, if you walk around outside, it won't be long before you come across bushes dripping with elderberries. Unlike elderflowers, though, there aren't lots of ideas for how to use them for cooking. Well, it's our food of the fortnight, and shortly Alex Rushmore will be along with some ideas for using them. First, though, a bit of elderberry background from Liz Budd.
The elder is rich in folklore. It was once believed that witches turned themselves into elder bushes to avoid detection, and they would bleed if cut. In Kent, an alternative name for the elder is the Judas tree, because it was believed that Judas hanged himself from one. In Derbyshire, they are also known as Devil's Wood. Many health claims are made for the elder, and it was much used in ancient medicine. However, parts, including the stem and leaves, are poisonous. People once beat their fruit trees and vegetables with fruiting branches of elder to impregnate them with the scent of the elderberries to deter insects. The juice of elderberries was used as a hair dye by Romans. The flowers and berries have been used in food since ancient times.
Also a little bit of a slightly earthy quality to them as well. I think it's a very interestingly flavoured fruit. Jams, chutneys, cordials are all options, but I love pairing them with game meat, actually. I think elderberry with grouse is very good. If you make a red wine or a port sauce, instead of red currant jelly, you add elderberry jelly and then some fresh or even pickled elderberries to the sauce, just to give it a little bit of acidity. It's also superb with venison. So if you do have a slow-cooked haunch of venison or a venison casserole or something, you can add elderberries to the dish just before it finishes cooking, just to give it that little bit of sweetness. Again, I'm a big fan of sort of enriching sauces and reductions with red currant jelly, traditionally with lamb. But again, if you have elderberry jam or elderberry jelly, really, really good just to add a finishing touch to a sauce.
Many thanks to Alex Rushmer. Wow, there were some really fascinating ideas there. I want to go out and grab my elderberries as soon as I can.
I would do, because I've got a recipe here that might interest you, because I've been looking out for some ideas for elderberries as well. So this is an extraordinary recipe for which you will need the patience of a saint. It's called Pontac sauce, and to make it, you simply pour a pint of boiling vinegar or red wine over a pint of elderberries in a casserole dish. You then put it in a very low oven with a lid on and leave it overnight. And then in the morning, pour the liquid off into a saucepan, add 1 teaspoonful of salt, a finely chopped onion, a little ginger, a blade of mace, a handful of cracked peppercorns, 40 if you want a number, and 12 cloves. And you boil for 10 minutes and then you bottle it with the spices. You then leave it for 7 years, and that's why you need patience. And it's said to be good with liver.
I think if I'd have waited for 7 years, I might put it with something slightly more inspiring than liver myself, but there we are.
Well, I am told that, you know, it is okay after one, but I'm going to make it.
So ask me
in 7 years' time what it's like. I'll bring it in.
Fair enough.
And if you can't remember the details of that recipe, various versions of it can be found online. Remember, it's called Pontac sauce. And more elderberry ideas shortly, but first... That music signals, of course, time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yeah, quite a few this morning. Bushel Box Farm in Willingham, their cafe is open today and tomorrow with Hot Numbers coffee and homemade cakes. And the homemade cakes include plum cake and apple cake, and they are made with their own plums and apples. That's in Station Road, Willingham. And, of course, they have got plums and apples for sale as well. Plums are still available. They have Victoria, Greengages, Marjorie Seedlings, Verity and Queen's Crown. Alex Rushmer, who we heard from only a moment ago, has tweeted congratulations to Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern on his appearance on BBC One Saturday Kitchen this very morning. Now, I was preparing for Flavour, so I missed it, so I play a calls, I think. Alimentum Restaurant in Hills Road has tweeted they have some slots tonight for 9 or 9.30. Tom's Cakes in Mill Road and also in St Ives has apple and treacle cake back on the menu, signalling the start of autumn. And finally, the Green Man in Grantchester has a new menu starting today, and that includes various foraged items, including elderberry ketchup.
Mm-hmm.
There you are.
Sounds great. And time for another elderberry recipe. This one is short and simple. Elderberry and apple crumble. Use a pound of apples and 12 ounces elderberries with 4 ounces sugar. Put the whole lot in a heat-proof dish, top with a crumble made in the usual way, and cook at 180 degrees for about 40 minutes.
Lovely. Okay, if you go along to Gonville Place at the moment, you will see some work in progress at the Gonville Hotel. It's to create a terrace for Cotto. The work was supposed to be completed months ago, but there were problems with water runoff should it rain heavily. Alan spoke with Chef Hans Schweitzer last year, and he has a remarkable story.
Hans, you've worked in a lot of countries, including Iran.
Yes, I was probably the last 2 years of the Shah's reign. I was in Iran, and it was such an incredible experience because they're such lovely people, and it's a shame it's been slightly wrongly represented in the political world these days, in our religious world. But culinary-wise, it was incredible because, you know, everyone thinks, the Chinese think they do the best rice, the Japanese, the Indians, but the best rice comes from Iran, there's no question. They have such a microclimate up by the Caspian Sea. The corns are nearly an inch long and the flavors are absolutely incredible. They have their bread, they do a flat bread, and they bake it in like a dome of burning pebble stones and with a beautiful crust, and there's so many lovely elements. Or, you know, the seafood from the Gulf, they got this huge prawns and Caspian Sea with the caviar, and it was an exciting experience to work there with a huge culinary history which goes back to the emperors of India, the influence from the Persian war in India, and some of the spices they brought with them. So it was a completely different experience.
But for you, being a chef with your roots in the West, were you cooking sort of Western food, or were you adopting the...
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of like an administrative executive job. I had 80 chefs, you know, so I was delegating the whole thing, and it was quite funny in those days. We're talking 30 years ago, and you had to sort of wear a white jacket with gold buttons, and I said, why do you have to wear this? And I said, because people respect you more. So it was like wearing a uniform in a circus. But professionally, it was incredible. We had like 10 butchers, and it was a huge experience for me.
Yes, yeah. And also you worked in Istanbul.
We opened a hotel. I was only there for a couple of weeks, but it was different again. It was more westernized, and but also, you know, Turkey has got some beautiful produce, and you know, it's just onions, basic things like aubergine, and they all taste fresh in the summer. They just taste different, tomatoes, you know, and the herbs and parsley and all of that.
And the fish as well.
Oh, fish, yeah. And the lemons and citrus fruit. It's incredible. Yeah.
So some great experiences. Yeah. So you draw on them all here in Cotto.
I try and put them back together, yeah.
That's fantastic. Cotto's now moved and is part of the Gonville Hotel. I'm wondering why the move took place and how it's gone.
We have moved because we felt we have outgrown the old Cotto. I feel it was very, very hard on our service staff to go up the stairs and down 50, 60, 17 times a night. And it sort of became apparent that we must do a change. And when the opportunity came up to join a Gonville Hotel as a partner with Cotto Restaurant, we took the opportunity and we created, as you can see, the brand new, beautiful dining room, which is very full of lights. You can see Parker's Piece, and we are creating a lovely terrace to go with it. So that was an obvious choice for us to come here.
Yes, well, this is very nice. And has it worked well?
Oh, we are very, very busy, yeah, and we're very happy with the way it goes so far.
And your menu is similar to the style of menu you had originally, presumably?
That's, you know, going back a little bit, because you always get asked as a chef, so what do? You do Italian? Do you French? What is it? And, you know, having a history as a chef, being cooking over a dozen of different countries, I have to sort of go back to my roots and sort of probably get the best bits from everywhere. It was a bit of like cosmopolitan cuisine, but the roots are actually British produce and products, and which we find here in this fantastic country with, you know, the sea around. You get beautiful seafood, fish, best lamb in the world from here. And don't forget, cheese has become incredibly good in this country, and some of the cheeses are better than in France. So it's really a pleasure to work here as a chef.
So tell us about some of the things that are on the menu now, which you're particularly pleased with.
I mean, one of my bestsellers is still our sort of seafood soup, and it's a little bit like a French bisque, but the history of that is when I went to Grenada, and I worked in the Caribbean for 12 years, and I went to a friend's home, and his mother was sort of doing a soup for us, and it was so full of flavor. I said, how do you make that soup so wonderful? And he said, you have to use the head of the shrimps and the lobsters to get the flavors. So then I copied that and added my own ingredients and came up with this beautiful soup, and my customer seems to love it, and got different types of seafood in it, some little baby organic vegetables, and it's absolutely delicious. So that's I recommend it to everyone.
any meat dishes?
If you cook meat, you want the roasting flavors, you want the juices, and you only get them if you keep the fat on and the bones. So we went back to our rack of lamb, roast it on the bone, sear and brown the fat, the outside, off the rack to get all the flavors, and then we brush it with mustard and make a beautiful herb crust. It's nearly a classic dish, but you can't really improve it. So I always recommend our lamb with a beautiful natural juice.
And any particular desserts you recommend?
Dessert, you know, I'm known as a chocolatier. As you know, I worked in Paris and Switzerland to train as a chocolatier, but I've been looking back to my culinary history, and I came up with the idea of the memories of the Caribbean, and I have created a West Indian dessert which sort of includes caramelized bananas, char grilled pineapples soaked in a nice spicy West Indian syrup, and we serve that with a coconut passion fruit ice cream and little sort of crumbles, and which replicates the sea, and it's a beautiful combination of flavors and textures, and I thought that's quite exciting. It's not something which grows in this country, but you know, bananas is so common these days, it's quite nice to do something with it.
Does the menu change regularly?
We change, not the menu, but we change items on it,
yeah.
Because some of our regulars would be too shocked if everything would be new one day, and so they'll like some of our sort of, let's say, standard dishes, and we're not going to touch them too much, but there are constant moves on our menus, you know, new desserts here, new starter, different main course, fish is always different, so there are slight changes all the time.
Yeah, so does that mean you're spending part of your week developing new dishes then?
We came up with something for the summer with the Cambridge strawberries and berries, but we're already planning for that with a very, very thin, fine meringue, and we call it probably something like Cambridge mess with berries and chantilly cream, and make it a sort of an enlightened kind of eaten mess, really, but it comes along really beautifully.
Now, talking about your chocolatier expertise, I mean, yeah. You have been named as one of the 10 world's best chocolatiers. And I remember reading a story about you making some miniature chocolate pianos for Pavarotti.
Yeah, that's the story. You know, when I worked at Sandy Lane, Pavarotti used to stay with us every
year. That's in Barbados.
That's in Barbados, yeah. The best hotel in the Caribbean. And Pavarotti came with his entourage, and they used to stay 3 weeks every year in March before their American tour. One night, he gave a concert for the island, basically, and it was absolutely fantastic. But after that, he wanted to have a party on the beach, so he invited 250 guests, and he said, I want something in a musical theme, and something many people never knew, that Pavarotti actually played the piano, and we had a beautiful baby Grant, and he said, what can you do? I said, okay, let's work on that. So I created the baby Grant piano out of chocolate, and it used to be, and it still is a big hit. It's not on the menu at the moment because I made so many of them, thousands of pianos, so I gave it a break, but people still come and ask for it.
So the 200 chocolate pianos weren't all for Pavarotti himself then?
No, it was a set menu, and everyone had the piano, and ever since it's been on the menu, really, it's been because it's been so successful.
And there's also an extraordinary story about you cooking some Dover sole for Muhammad Ali.
When we took over at the Skyline Hotel in London, our company, and I was sort of introducing our kitchen policies, I had this phone call one morning and said, Muhammad Ali is up in the suite and he needs 3 or 4 Dover soles, but he doesn't want to come down because he just lost his fight last night. He just flew over from Las Vegas. So I said, okay, turn on the flambe trolley and put on a big pan, and I took 3 Dover soles up to his suite. And, you know, there was a bodyguard and some, you know, PR people, and they said, oh, he's in his bedroom, just go in there. Well, I went in, and suddenly this lady jumped out of the bed with his red negligee on. And, anyway, Mohammed, he came out of the shower. I said, come in, don't worry about that. And so I cooked the dovers all for him. And I never knew which sort of impact that would have on my life eventually, you know, because it was such an incredible moment.
Yeah, right.
One quite interesting story about when Her Majesty the Queen, she was coming to Barbados, and the Prime Minister called me. I was already here in Cambridge and asked me if I could do the function for 2,000 people on Alora Court, which is the government building. So, okay, I come over. So everything sort of, we arranged the whole party, and we had all the different foods and canapes and drinks and anything you wanted. And it was sort of late afternoon, evening, 6 o'clock. And we asked the Queen what she would like to have to drink. And she said, I have a cup of tea. I thought, oh my God. One thing we don't have is tea. So the butler, he ran down to the kitchen and started putting on the kettle to make the tea. And he came up with this beautiful silver tray with all this, you know, teas and everything. And all he saw, the Queen, gone back into her Rolls Royce and drove off. And that was a very sad moment, because everything we'd done was for the Queen, but the only thing she wanted was tea, and she couldn't get it.
On the subject of sourcing, how much work does that take? It strikes me that you've been pretty thorough, because some of your bread is cooked in Cambridge, isn't it, by Alison MacTaggart?
Alison, I don't want to tell everyone because I want to have your bread, but no, Alison is probably the best artisan baker I have met in a long time. And I'm a big fan of San Francisco sourdough, and I used to do that when I worked in San Francisco. But she is top, and she does a couple of very special breads for us. We bake a lot of bread ourselves, but she does the cumin and potato bread, which is out of this world, and her walnut and raisin bread is also incredible. So we have a standard relationship there. But also, you know, a lot of products we try and get from Uppington is an organic farm, you know, get some nice little fresh vegetables, and we always try and source some different products. Sometimes it's not always possible, but we do try to be organic if we can. And it's getting better and better. There are more and more small farmers who actually produce that sort of kind of food, which is good news.
Yes. So you're getting a lot of local food. You mentioned before Michelin stars, and I know you've had Michelin stars in your time. Time Kotto got one, I think.
Actually, there was a bit of an uproar recently, because the Cambridge Evening News sort of named me sort of like the Michelin star chef has moved to Gonville Hotel, and I had the Michelin inspector here recently, and I told him that wasn't my intention. I don't want to decorate myself with something I don't have. But the fact is, I used to have a Michelin star, and I'm very proud I used to have one. And maybe we get one again one day. You don't know.
Well, I think you should.
Thank you.
Hans Schweitzer from Kotto in Gonville Place there, now reopened after its summer break.
Mm. Now on to our final recipe for elderberries, and it's for elderberry and apple jelly. And to do this, you simply cut up 3 pounds of cooking apples and add to a pan with 4 pints of elderberries. Add 2 pints of water and simmer to a pulp, and then strain through muslin overnight. For every pint of juice you get, you add a pound of sugar, and you heat them together with the peel of an orange and half a stick of cinnamon. And that's it. That recipe is from a Fenland Village cookery book by Liz Brown, and it's quoted in Wild Food by Roger Phillips.
And let's head back now to wine country once again. This time we are talking Chardonnay with Steve Hovington of the Cambridge Wine Academy.
I'm going to show you a good time. We're going to drink a lot of good wine. We're going to play some golf. We're going to eat some great food and enjoy the scenery. And we're going to send you off in style, Wilfred.
Chardonnay is worldwide. It began in the Chablis Burgundy region because the grape is, well, the grape is so effective at growing in so many different conditions. And Steve, I guess that's the reason why we've chosen Chardonnay today. You've given talks in the past about the New World Wines and the Paris Conference.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that was the so-called Judgment of Paris back in 1976.
Really, it's hard to imagine that one tasting could change international opinion so dramatically.
That was the first time that New World wines were taken as being on a par with some of the finest wines in Europe or the Old World, so to speak. So,
yes, yeah. picking Chardonnay for today personifies that, because Chardonnay is grown all across the world now, not just the old world. Yeah. And the old world in this case is Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now you can find it in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, even Britain. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to try and talk about today, is what Chardonnay means in those regions and how it varies and why it varies.
Yeah.
First off, can we explain the difference between a New World and an Old World Chardonnay?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, it might have been a much more significant difference. But these days, there is so much similarity between Chardonnay styles with modern winemaking that sometimes it's hard to see where the join is. Mm. So the template for fine Chardonnay winemaking is Burgundy, the Bourgogne region of France. That's where the grape comes from. That's where the finest wines have been traditionally produced and still are. You know, the classic Chablis style, for instance, is an un-oaked Chardonnay from the northern part of Burgundy, where it's very, very cool, and they have this kind of limestone chalk soil. It's very fresh and very full of acidity and mineral characteristics, usually without oak. But if you go a bit further south into an area called the Côte d'Or, the Golden Slope, it's a bit warmer, and you find that the character of the Chardonnay grape changes a little bit, because Chardonnay does change its characteristics depending on the climate where it's grown.
Mm.
It's one of its good things, but it's also a bit of a drawback. Sometimes it's hard to pin down exactly what Chardonnay tastes like, because it can vary so much. You know, in that cool climate Chablis area, it's an extremely different style from a warm or hot climate. Sorry, that's just Coco. She's coming in.
Yes, what do you want?
You know, where it's a lot warmer, so the fruit character of the grape changes from that kind of apple citrus character to more sort of stone fruit, peach, tropical mango characteristic.
Don't be shy. Really get your nose right in there, really. A little citrus, maybe some strawberry, passion fruit, and oh, there's just like the faintest sousson of like asparagus, and there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Wow. The Burgundy region is the classic region for Chardonnay.
Mm.
Strawberries, yeah.
Good.
Strawberries.
Yeah.
Not the cheese.
You know, it has this combination of soil, climate, and tradition that helps to produce very long-lived, very fine examples of Chardonnay, which usually in the Côte d'Or will be oak-influenced and oak-aged.
Yes.
Okay. As you go a bit further south then, you come to sort of areas like the Côte Chalonnaise or the Mâconnais, where the Chardonnays start to become a little bit fresher and lighter again. You know, they don't have the intensity that they do in the Côte d'Or region.
Mm.
That region of France really is the, you know, sets the gold standards for winemakers around the world in many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you go to California, when you go to the Napa Valley or Sonoma County or the Central Coast, many of the winemakers there will be influenced by the winemaking techniques that have been used in the Burgundy region, which is barrel fermentation, stirring the dead yeast cells or the least stirring, malolactic fermentation, which is a big word, a big sort of mouthful, but it just enhances when people say this wine tastes creamy and buttery.
Yeah.
Chardonnay, what they're talking about is the malolactic fermentation that's allowed to happen once the fermentation's finished and the sugars have been converted to alcohol. There's this malolactic that takes place. And with Chardonnay, that buttery, creamy character is often seen as a good thing to enhance the richness, because Chardonnay is richer.
I need a drink.
These guys make top-notch Pinot and Chardonnay, one of the best producers in Santa Barbara County.
I thought you hated Chardonnay.
No. I like all varietals. I just don't generally like the way they manipulate Chardonnay in California. Too much oak and secondary malolactic fermentation.
Huh.
What you're getting these days is a move a little bit away from that over-oaked style prevalent back in the 80s. It's a bit like the music of the time in the 80s, because everything was overproduced. Everything but the kitchen sink was thrown into the songs, you know. Nowadays, I suppose with music as well, there's a tendency things to be stripped back and moving back, you know, and sort of taking heed of the fact that although it is still the most widely planted white grape variety in the world, it has lost its credibility in many respects with the consumers, because it was overly oaked, perhaps. But so winemakers are conscious of this, and what you're getting now is some fantastic restrained, fresher styles. And when the oak is used, it's used in a subtle way to add flavours. I mean, New World winemakers, that's why I'm saying it's kind of, it's too easy just to say there's a big divide between New and Old World. There isn't. So an Australian winemaker, for instance, in Victoria or Margaret River, might be seeking to create a style of wine which is restrained, which is pure in fruit character, and allowing the grape variety more, you know, fruit character to the fore, rather than smother it with lots and lots of flavours, because oak barrels obviously can add flavours.
And it's interesting to see how Chardonnay has been developed across the countries. One that particularly caught my attention was Chile. Yeah. Chile was, as far as I'm aware, a region that was well known for producing bulk. Not necessarily that great quality, but that's something that's certainly changed in the last few decades.
Yeah.
They've become noted, again, for their Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chile! Viva Chile, po!
Chile is an interesting wine-producing country. It's got quite a long tradition of winemaking, and although it's a very thin country, east to west, in fact, all the climatic differences occur east to west, even though it's about 1,000 miles long, which is a bit strange. But in terms of winemaking, you've got the Pacific Ocean, of course, which is going to be cooler, and it's going to bring in cool breezes and ocean currents, the Humboldt Current, and it cools down the temperatures by the coast. Then you've got the Central Valley, and it gets hotter, and then you've got the foothills of the Andes, and you know, and then you've got a bit of mountains and altitude, and that cools down the temperatures. So, you know, in the space of 100 or so kilometres, you've got a lot of range of climate conditions to grow wine. And what you find is that, again, modern winemakers are looking to make fresher, more restrained styles of Chardonnay. To do that, they need to be looking at cool climate areas within Chile.
Yeah.
Where it is actually Chile, believe it or not, you know. And you get right on the coast there. I tasted a very nice one on Saturday at the Royston Wine Fair by Viña Carmen, which is one of the oldest wineries in Chile, called Gran Reserva Chardonnay. The vineyard is in Casablanca Valley, less than 30 kilometres away from the coast. And that slows down the ripening period, so the flavours and the quality of the grapes gets transferred into the wines itself. And I was struck by how refreshing it was, you know, and how, yes, there was some creaminess in there, but overall it had this wonderful fresh acidity. I think it's an example of where many New World Chardonnays are going. Of course, there's always going to be the rich, buttery, complex, gold-coloured, mouth-filling wines. But, you know, you can produce in the cooler climate regions of the New World some very exciting, such as Elgin in South Africa, Adelaide Hills in Australia. And I tasted a very good one from Argentina, in fact, from the familiar Zuccardi, their Q Chardonnay, which is very pure, very fresh. Sort of a really wonderful example of when a winemaker chooses to explore expressing the grape variety and letting the grape and the area and the place, that whole thing about terroir, come through in the wine. Because, I mean, Chardonnay can express itself dependent upon where it's grown. So with Zuccardi, you've got this calcium carbonate soil, and you've got the altitude and the mountain waters, and all this contributes with the cold nights and the hot days to this special environment. And if you handle that well, then you're going to create a world-class wine.
Yeah.
The cold air off the Pacific flows in at night, and it just cools down the berries.
For anybody who doesn't know, that's essentially what terroir means, isn't it? It's the combination of all of those environmental elements working together?
Yeah. It's written into the Appellation Contrôlée laws, really. It's what makes those wines unique, and that is a combination of the climate, the soil, the angle of the slopes. Even individual vineyards can have such a special history of producing great wine that they have their own appellation. So, yeah, that would be it.
Britain, Britain, Britain.
You know, we've been banded so heavily with the intense heat. You told me you were on holiday. Yeah, I'm not knocking it, but that's one of the things, isn't it? There wasn't much opportunity for wine growing in this country for so many years, but now that is changing. The climate is changing. Now there is more and more opportunity for vineyards in the UK, and is that true as well for Chardonnay?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of industry has come on leaps and bounds.
Because I noticed there's a few places they're producing in Essex, Sussex and Kent.
Yeah.
They were describing their wines being much more of the old world complexion, containing a mixture of red apple and citrus, but also stony fruits and lots of minerality.
Yeah. You could work in a wine store, Miles.
Yeah, that'd be a good move.
Are you chewing gum?
There's a good website for this, actually. It's called greatbritishwine.com for anyone who's interested. I mean, we even have a local vineyard, don't we? We have the Chilford Hall Vineyard over in Linton.
Yeah, there's some very nice wines they are too. Funny enough, we had a French visitor the other night and he brought a English still white wine with him. I think he's a good sense of humour, but anyway. Gifford Hall, I think it's from Suffolk. Anyway, it's made from this great variety called Bacchus, which is probably our best hope at the moment of a distinctive grape that could be synonymous with England, I mean, at the moment. Anyway, we had Dover Sole with it, kind of a bit patriotic. And, you know, once you season the fish and you add a squeeze of lemon and stuff, the wine worked very, very nicely with it. You know, once vineyards have become more established in the UK, because it does take a few years to establish a vineyard, and once the vines get a bit older and they started to produce better quality fruit, and, you know, perhaps we've had a few consecutively good vintages, and particularly for the sparkling wine industry, they're able to build up a supply of reserve wines, which is normally the case. I think the future is bright. I mean, there are some very modern-looking English still white wines made from Chardonnay. I think it's that combination of passion and winemaking and the grape, and I think we could have some great wines, yeah.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much, Steve.
No problem. Thank you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Many thanks to Steve Hovington, who runs the Wine, Spirits and Education courses, the WSET, at the Cambridge Wine Merchants Cherry Hinton Road Branch and at the University Centre.
And this is Booker T and the MGs with Green Onions, signalling the start of our news section, and we begin with jobs.
Bills in Green Street needs a kitchen porter, salary and benefits up to £8.50 per hour, a section chef up to £10 per hour, wait and bar staff up to £10 per hour. Apply via Bills Cambridge website.
Culinaris in Mill Road has full and part-time vacancies. To apply, send a CV with a covering letter to shop@culinaris.co.uk. And Pint Shop in Pease Hill needs some front-of-house people, and they've got a recruitment day on the 24th of September. If you want to be involved, send your CV to cambridge@pintshop.co.uk.
The Kingston Arms has been undergoing a major revamp lately, and it's now in need of kitchen assistants for 10 to 30 hours a week. Pay is National Living Wage. Just pop in with your CV or to chat about it. The position is available immediately.
Cam's Cuisine is always looking for good staff for one of their 8 establishments in and around Cambridge. They're also looking to open 2 new places this year, so you might want to get on their books. Download an application form from their website.
Heard about them here on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And today and tomorrow on Parker's Piece, we have, of course, the Cambridge Food and Garden Produce Show. Started at 10, all the way through to 5 this evening, and tomorrow evening it's free to enter.
Also today, from 3 till 11 p.m, Thirsty is hosting a one-day beer garden at St Andrew's Church in Cherry Hinton. They'll be accompanied by Honest Burger and the Cambridge Film Festival, along with a comedy show and other activities. It's free to all.
And Thirsty is also running an Oktoberfest on the 27th to the 30th of September at One Hills Road, just by Parker's Peace and the Catholic Church. Tickets from Eventbrite. It'll be like the beer garden at St Giles, only under canvas. Calverley's is brewing 2 special beers for the event, a Märzen and a Crystal Wheat. And there will also be a festival brew from the Gypsy Hill Brewery in London. Honest Burgers, along with other food traders, including Veggie, will be providing the eats, and there will also be Bavarian snacks at the bar.
Yeah, and finally, looking ahead to next year, the dates for Eat Cambridge 2019 have been announced by Director Heidi White. The festival will run from the 11th to the 26th of May. Applications for stalls for the big event, so that will be on the 11th of May at the Guildhall, and to host fringe events can be made online at eatcambridge.co.uk.
And that's all we have time for today. If you miss bits, nod it off, or just want to hear us again and again, remember, we're on alternative Saturdays at 1 p.m. and then podcast early in the next week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can contact us on Twitter @flavour105. Coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio, it's Classical Cambridge, the monthly show presented by Mark Liversidge on the classical music scene in the city. At 5 p.m, Polish Waves returns with another hour of Polish culture in Cambridge, and from 6 till 7, it's From the Terraces, Tim Armitage and the team covering the gamut of footballing action from Cambridge United, Cambridge City and Histon Town. John Hammond takes over at 7 with the Big Band Show, featuring not only the likes of Glenn Miller and Count Basie, but vocalists as well, such as Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. Let the Good Times Roll is on at 8, presented by Jackie Bond. That's rock and roll from the 50s right up to the present day. And then Rebel Arts Radio takes over at 9 p.m, focusing on political issues addressed through the medium of the arts. That's presented by Pete Monahan, Mark Evans and Johnny Cabbage. Stagger is at 10 o'clock. That's an hour of rap, electronica and experimental music. And we round off the evening with Bookmark, the fortnightly literary review show featuring Cambridge authors. So that's your schedule for the rest of the day.
We'll be back on the 29th of September. But until then, we'll play out with Flavour's answer to Slow Radio. By request, here's more of Liz Budd's soothing rendition of Pint Shop's Gin List, part of our gin special from our last programme. Hear it on the podcast if you missed it. So until the 29th of September,
goodbye.
And take it away, Liz.
Beckett's 40%. Juniper from Box Hill. Boodles, 40%. Coriander, nutmeg, rosemary. Brockman's Intensely Smooth, 40%. Blueberries, blackberries. Cambridge Dry Gin, 42%. Blackcurrant leaf, rosemary, rose. Conker, 40%. Elderberries, samphire, gorseflowers. Copperhead, 40%. Orange, coriander, cardamom. Cotswold, 46%. Bay leaf, black pepper, grapefruit. Daffy's Small Batch, 43.4%. Mint, orange, lemon. Dodds, 49.9%. Honey, raspberry leaf, lime. East London Liquor Company, 40%.